No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Kathleen Gomez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008 or Skype us at BBS Radio 1. We have a special guest with us tonight, Dr. Malik Burnett. As policy manager for the Drug Alliance's Office of National Affairs, Dr. Burnett worked on reform of marijuana laws in the nation's capital by helping pass Initiative 71, which legalized the possession and personal use of marijuana through a ballot measure, which was overwhelmingly passed by D.C. voters in November. In addition, he is working with the D.C. Council to develop a tax and regulatory system that will codify this measure into D.C. law. He holds an MBA and an MD from Duke University, where he serves on the university's Board of Trustees. We're looking forward to an interesting conversation with Dr. Burnett because the fight for marijuana isn't over in the district. In fact, in some ways, it has just begun. Issues of sovereignty, self-determination, and statehood are part of the equation, and we hope our discussion will shed some light on these issues as well as what the future holds for the implementing of this legislation. We want to know what you think, so let us hear from you at 888-628-6008 or Skype us with your questions. Before I go any further, let me introduce my co-host, Kathleen, who is on her way back to Arizona this week in search of warmer weather. Kathleen, are you there?
Yes, I am. But, you know, I'm going to go by way of Kansas first and then go to Arizona. So hopefully when I come back, and I know you can't wait for me to come back. You're just so sad to see me go. But I'll be back in April. And hopefully I'll bring some nice warm weather because it is a little bit hard to get used to, this weather out here on the East Coast.
That's the thing I like most about you is that you vacation in Kansas in the wintertime. There's not a lot of people that do that. A lot of people are going to Puerto Vallarta or, you know, or Miami, but you're going
that's
to Kansas,
true.
And that's what makes you special. Before Kathleen introduces our special guests tonight, I'd like to make a statement because I'm so offended by this as a Democratic politician. But I think it's reprehensible that 47 Republican senators sent a letter to Iran, potentially undercutting the President of the United States' effort to negotiate an international agreement with a nation that just a few years ago held many of our diplomats hostage. Kathleen and I both worked for Jimmy Carter. We both remember those days. It wasn't that long ago. What are these crazy people thinking? One thing that somebody wrote in the Washington Post today was that 7 Republican senators did not sign that letter. She's calling them the Magnificent 7. I agree with her. Let's get these guys reelected and forget about those 47 bums who are out there trying to undercut the effort of our president and his administration. It's just outrageous. Rather than read the 47, I'd like to read the names of the Magnificent 7 who didn't sign. Senator Flake of Arizona, Senator Cooker of Tennessee, Senator Collins of Maine, Senator Alexander of Tennessee, Lisa Murkowski, Senator from Alaska, Dan Coats from Indiana, and Thad Cochran from Mississippi. bravo, guys, for standing up for America. I'm sorry.
And I must say, a lot of times you really give me a hard time for being from Arizona. But, you know, Flake, I have to give him a shout out for that. I'm really surprised. He's turning out to be a pretty, if you can call conservatives good, which you can. I think he's turning out to be a really good guy. I mean, he's done some good things about the issues on the border. But I am really, really surprised that he held his own and he knew this was wrong and he didn't go with McCain. And I'm sure he was pressured to do what the other 47 do. And I think the other 47 should just be impeached. Do you want to talk about impeachment? I think this is something that they should have. And you know me, I'm not thrilled with the Democrats right now, but I tell you, this is just terrible. And if it, you know, whether it was a Republican or a Democratic president, this is just wrong. So in that matter.
Finally an issue that you and I agree on.
Finally an issue. And I guess with that, I really want to, I'm looking forward to this conversation we're going to have because, you know, right now, this whole marijuana issue is in the, you know, it's front and center and statehood's right there with it. So let me introduce our guest, Dr. Is it Malik Burnett? Am I saying it right, doctor?
Hey, how are you? Thanks for having me. It's Malik Burnett.
Malik Burnett. Yep. Listen, thank you so much for joining us. Let me ask you how you got involved in this issue. Because I gather that you were up in the Northeast and you came to D.C. because something brought you to this issue. Can you explain to the audience what that was?
Sure. So I was up in Massachusetts practicing general surgery and also working with the Massachusetts Department of Health to bring together their medical marijuana program. When I started looking at the issue a lot closer beyond the health benefits and the potential to, you know, combat the heroin epidemic. There is an issue around, you know, marijuana as a pretext or a gateway to the criminal justice system. And looking at the numbers in D.C., where you're 8 times more likely to be arrested as an African-American, when I was invited to come down and help take marijuana completely out of the criminal justice system, under a racial justice context, I had to jump at the opportunity.
Well, you know, doctor, let's talk about a few of these issues, because that statistic that you just threw out there last week, our delegate, Eleanor Holmes Norton, said that that's not only true in Washington, D.C., but in general, that's true across America. So that's, you know, a really important issue. And is that true? Is that generally what we find in other big cities, that African Americans are much more likely to be arrested and get a criminal record for marijuana than white people who use it at approximately the same rate?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. So the national average, you're 4 times more likely as an African American to be brought into the criminal justice system for possession of marijuana. As you said, in spite of the fact that marijuana use is pretty equal across race, in the district that we have the dubious distinction of having probably the most egregious enforcement against African Americans. And so it was really incumbent that here in the nation's capital, we focused our election and campaign around the issue of, you know, racial justice. And it was the first campaign in the country to run a marijuana legalization campaign under that auspices of racial justice. So definitely groundbreaking work that's taking place here in the district.
Yeah, you guys did a really great job. And I would like to talk to you about some of the other issues that still remain. Sure. We've had Adam Idecker on the show, and Adam and I, as you probably know, Doc, were arrested together, standing up for women's medical rights, for funding for medical procedures for poor women. Adam's quite an activist, and I know you guys work closely. But he's brought up a couple of issues that still remain in the district. One of them, which I think people don't think about much, is that there's a federal prohibition for against using marijuana, and we have a lot of federal properties in the District of Columbia where you would still be arrested if you were caught with pot. But in addition to that, one of the biggest problems when you talk about race is public housing. the law does not extend to public housing. And since a lot of poor people are minorities and they live in public housing, they're still being discriminated against on the basis of where they live. And is there any, do you think there's anything we can do about this short of changing the federal law?
You know, unfortunately, this is like an issue that is left squarely in the purview of the federal government. You know, public housing is a federally subsidized entity, and largely inside of when you're running into conflicts between local and federal law, as it relates to marijuana, being that it's still on Schedule One, it's federally illegal, and unfortunately, people who are in public housing will get continue to face discrimination. It was interesting that they tried to use the public housing argument to derail Initiative 71 before it even got out the gate, but fortunately, in court proceedings, that was found to be an unfounded sort of ruling towards invalidating the will or the ability of the people of the district to weigh in on the issue, and unfortunately we were able to move forward. But, you know, there's still a lot of work to do as it relates to reconciling the differences between local and federal law. But, you know, we made some headway this week when Senators Rand Paul, Cory Booker, and Kirsten Gillibrand introduced the CARES Act in the United States Senate, which would remove marijuana from the Schedule One and put it into Schedule Two, in addition to solving a whole host of other issues as it relates to marijuana, expanding access for veterans, and having VA doctors be able to talk about or prescribe medical marijuana, recommend it, providing banking access for the 33 states that have medical marijuana dispensaries and cultivation centers, you know, increasing public safety. A whole host of things. So we're making incremental progress on the issue at the federal level, but, you know, there's still a lot more work to be done.
Well, that's why, I mean, this was from what I get from what you stated. And of course, here I haven't lived in Washington. I lived a long time in D.C. many years ago. But to the people who are listening outside of the D.C., basically, you came into this law because it is African Americans who are getting arrested, or if they are in jail 8 times more, they are the ones, they have possession of marijuana, or using it, or selling it. Now, in the public housing is where they live, right? And in a sense, this is what you were trying to change, was the fact, as it stands right now, if you are living in federal subsidized housing, you would not be able to partake in anything. You could be arrested and sent to jail. Is that the way it is as of today?
That is correct. You know, unfortunately, we can't force federally subsidized agencies to comply with the local rules of the District of Columbia. And so people who are in public housing continue to face the prospects of arrest for possessing marijuana.
Then let me ask you this. In the state of Colorado, if they are living in federal housing, they would not be arrested in the state of Colorado, would they?
No, they would be.
Oh, they still would be. Okay.
This problem uniquely is not a district problem. This is a problem across the country. You know, federal law prevents people from using federally banned substances, and public housing, given the fact that it's funded federally, you know, creates a problem. But, you know, the more and more we can kind of highlight these discrepancies and incongruence in the federal law, the more and more we can lobby and discuss this issue with our elected officials, and, you know, bring federal law into better compliance with what people on the ground want. You know, public opinion is moving in a rapid clip towards ending the ban on marijuana, and so, you know, the more we can highlight these you know, egregious sort of discrepancies and problems, then the more and more we can build a case for change.
That's true.
Well, what do you think when it comes to the law, Dr. Burnett? What do you think about the law that we've passed, Initiative 71? I'm sure it was a compromise on some levels, but do you think it's a fair level, that a fair law that the limits are 2 ounces of marijuana? You can possess 2 ounces of marijuana. And you can grow up to 3 plants in your home. These are all for personal use. You're not allowed to sell it. You're not allowed to grow it outside. Right. Do you think this was a fair law that we passed?
You know, I think it was a great law or a great strategy given the confines that we were placed under. It's against the law in most states, you know, when they've moved forward, at least in the 4 states where they've moved forward in ending marijuana prohibition completely, they have also been intentional about legalizing the sale and creating a regulated system for access to marijuana. Unfortunately, in the District of Columbia, it is against the law to put anything on ballot initiative that would affect the funding structure of the local government. So we couldn't actually put a provision which would legalize sales or, you know, create this regulated system on the ballot. So, you know, the most important thing about this was ending the, you know, criminal penalties and prohibition and criminal records for people of color in the district. And so we were basically forced to pursue a strategy where we at least make possession legal, and then we would have the city council, which was actively working towards passing a law that would allow for legalized sales and regulated access to marijuana. But, you know, due to the fact that Congress has interfered, that process has been slowed down.
Well, let me ask you something. Last week, the mayor and D.C. council passed legislation saying that you can't smoke it outdoors, you can't smoke it in private clubs or only in private homes. Is that correct? So I guess in your backyard you could do it, or does it have to be inside? It's kind of strange because I have a lot of people that ask me from out of D.C., you know, how is D.C. doing this? I mean, where is it that you can smoke and where is it that you can't? And this is something that you guys kind of thought would happen, that it would be where you could do it in your home, but really not much where else? Or did you have more thinking it would be more applied on a bigger level, bigger picture, that you'd be able to have that freedom?
Yeah, so this is a great question. So the mayor passed or mayor introduced and or ultimately the council passed emergency legislation banning the use of marijuana in private clubs or entities registered with the District of Columbia for, you know, for a business purpose. So, you know, your typical nightclubs or anywhere where you could have smoke cigarettes in like an outside sort of patio sort of setting, they banned the use of marijuana. I think this, you know, violates the spirit because of the initiative, because what ends up happening is they're reimposing sort of criminal penalties on people who smoke in public. So you get a misdemeanor offense for smoking in public, which is largely going to be enforced against poor people of color because, you know, given the fact that low-income people of color are less likely to own their homes, they're more likely to smoke outside in public. And naturally, this is going to, you know, result in more biased enforcement of marijuana laws here in the District of Columbia. So it's an unfortunate sort of decision that the council took up. But to answer your second question, individuals can, you know, smoke inside their homes. You can smoke. I would say that you could smoke on your property, in your backyard. You know, all those sort of things. I doubt that you would get in trouble with the police there. The point of the initiative was to, you know, refocus police resources, so police shouldn't be spending a lot of time trying to find and harass people who are smoking on their patios or in their backyards or things of that nature. They should just be focusing on, you know, the real crime that is occurring inside the District of Columbia.
And let me just follow up with this question again. Then here is like this inequality, because if you're in Northwest and, you know, you the big homes and, you know, you have a nice big yard and some privacy, you're going to be okay. But if you're in public housing in Anacostia and, you know, and you're having a barbecue or you can't smoke at all. I mean, it just seems so, you know, once again, we're faced with the inequality of the law and the justice. And you know, I think this is great what you guys have done. And it just seems to show even more clearly how equal. There's no equality sometimes in the states, and we really have to stop it. We really have to have elect politicians who are going to be brave enough to deal with this issue, because I don't see it going anywhere. I just see more states and you know, as they talk with states' rights, that states should have the ability to say yes, they will allow it, or no, they won't, and it should be equal for everyone. So it's going to be really interesting. This is a real, I think, going to be kind of the discussion in the future and then for marijuana and for what we're going to do.
Absolutely. I think it was very interesting way back, you know, in May of last year when we started working on this. I was talking with some elected officials, and I tried to, highlight the point that as we take up this issue, you know, marijuana will become part of the home rule fight. At that point in time, not many people, believed what I was saying. They were a little skeptical. But as you can see, for probably the first time in my memory, you have the mayor, the newly elected attorney general, the chief of police, and significant members of the council all standing together on the day that, you know, the decision was made to stand up to congressional interference and, uphold the will of the voters and legalize Initiative 71. That was a big moment for self-determination inside the District of Columbia. And as we move forward and think about it, there is, the Congress has placed an appropriations rider, as they do in typical fashion, when they decide to interfere in the District of Columbia. They can't do it in the broad daylight for the open public to see. They use the appropriations process to try to, you know, stymie the district's activity. But they passed an appropriations rider in the omnibus package that was passed at the end of the fiscal year last year, preventing the district from moving forward to regulate sales of marijuana in the district. But as our good friend at DC Applefeed pointed out, the district has the capacity to actually circumnavigate this blocking by the Congress by using our contingency reserve fund. So the mayor can use and decide to use contingency reserve funds because the Congress can only block the district's use of funds for the fiscal year of 2015, and contingency reserve funds are not part of the fiscal year 2015 funding. So if the mayor wants to, you know, take a step further and, you know, proactively stand up for better public safety, better regulated sort of marketplace, eliminating the black market for marijuana sales, she can, you know, make the decision to be proactive. And I'm sure that the people of the District of Columbia will stand up behind her as she, you know, fights for self-determination.
Well, that, you know, that's certainly an issue that we want to discuss with you, Dr. Burnett, is that, this always happens to us in the District of Columbia. And my opinion of the marijuana fight, by the way, what you're doing, what Eidegger, what these other people are doing, is that you're helping the issue of statehood, because one of our problems that we have in statehood in the District of Columbia is that nobody feels our pain. When right. Michael Brown was shot in Ferguson, there were African Americans, there were people all over the country that could relate to that. But nobody can relate to not having representation, because we're the only people that find ourselves in that particular bag. And we expect that these guys will continue to interfere through the budget process and other things with this law as we go forward. But what do you think about this as a national movement? Do you think this helps us because people outside the district start to realize now that we don't have control over our own laws here in the district?
Absolutely. You know, I talk with members of the statehood contingency all the time, and you know, I was a little taken aback that they were a little reluctant to have the statehood issue be raised to the surface on the back of the marijuana issue. But the reality of the matter is that there's no vehicle that gets quite as much attention in the press as marijuana, at least in current times. And, you know, when the mayor decided to stand up for statehood, she ended up being on national television and was able to get onto the Rachel Maddow show and talk about, you know, the fight for representation inside the district. I think that, you know, going forward, that there's an opportunity to kind of highlight this and bring it to the consciousness of the American people nationally by using the issue of lack of ability to determine our own laws as it relates to marijuana in the District of Columbia. And that would, you know, bring the statehood fight to the national consciousness. You know, Republicans are going to have a real tough time reconciling their, you know, states' rights and federalism sort of philosophies when you know, they're going to be faced with trying to interfere with their local representation here in the district.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. Just a second, Kathleen. I think you're absolutely right about that. And I think that, you know, part of our problem has always been connecting the dots for people because they really don't understand. It's kind of an ethereal thing for most people across America. They really don't understand the implications, the practical implications of what we suffer here in the District of Columbia. But I think this very clearly shows them what this means to us as an issue that is typical of many issues that we have to deal with here in the district. I'm sorry, Kathleen, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, as an outsider and from, you know, traveling around, especially out in Arizona, California, Kansas and all that, I mean, I think it is something that people can understand and relate to, where when you talk to them about just the whether it's budget autonomy or, you know, home rule, whatever, they just get kind of a glazed look. They don't understand what you're talking about. But everybody can relate because the marijuana, like, you know, you look at the state of Arizona, it passed so that it allows medical marijuana now. That's unbelievable for a state of Arizona as conservative as it is. And the other issue, too, that I see the real inequality that's going to happen is who becomes the business owners of this new venture. You know, is it going to bring the people, the African Americans, along with it? Are they going to be able to become business or do business? I know there was a seminar a couple of weeks ago where there was like 476 people that turn up. And it just seems so funny how so many people are already seeing it as a money-making type of thing. I know in Arizona people talk about it because the ranching and the farming is very bad out there right now with droughts and with not getting any kind of work. But, you know, meanwhile, there's investors building greenhouses in Arizona to grow marijuana for medical purposes. And they're actually investors from outside of the United States because of the federal banks will loan for some kind of this kind of business because marijuana is illegal by federal law. So it's going to be interesting because I see all kinds of inequities happening if we have a chance now to kind of shape it. And it's very crucial. And whether you believe, I guess, in whether you should be able to smoke or not, to me, it's just more of an issue of civil rights. So I really think you guys are at the forefront of doing some great stuff in the sense that there's just so much that can happen. I mean, I hope I'm not being too crazy and going off the deep end here, but I just see so many things that are kind of things that we should be talking about. You know, are African Americans going to be able to produce it and sell it when that time comes? Because I think it's a matter of it just time. It's going to come.
No, I think you're right. I actually don't think you're going off the deep end at all in terms of this idea. We are actively working on crafting legislation in the D.C. Council that will, you know, use some of the revenues generated from the taxation and sale of marijuana to reinvest in the communities most harmed by the war on drugs. If you look at way that tax money is being used in Colorado and Washington, you're seeing tax dollars being going towards public education, building of schools, research for cannabis, and you know, all sorts of different things. But, you know, given the fact that our theme or focus around marijuana legalization here in the District of Columbia was one that was focused squarely on racial justice, you know, there's an opportunity to use some of the revenue generated from the legal sale of marijuana to reinvest in, you know, agencies like the Office of Returning Citizens, for example. There are 60,000 returning formerly incarcerated individuals in the District of Columbia. And, you know, the district is unique in that it has an office that's dedicated towards helping these people get back into, you know, mainstream society, finding jobs, getting education and things like that. And, you know, we could certainly use some of the revenues generated from the sale of marijuana to fortify and improve the access and ability of those services and entities, non-governmental entities and agencies or organizations that work with reentry in the District of Columbia. We can help subsidize and provide innovation grants for those groups, so that you're really like bringing this issue full circle, and you know, we're ending the criminal penalties and then using the revenues to help the people who have criminal penalties get back into society. So it's something that has it's kind of a really new sort of policy area inside the marijuana legalization movement, but the district has a real opportunity to kind of, you know, set the trend for this, and hopefully it'll be recapitulated across the nation.
Well, and I'd like to just say, while we're on the subject, that the District of Columbia, I think, has a great track record when it comes to this sort of thing. We have a thing called Ban the Box, where you're not allowed to ask people about their former arrests before they're interviewed for a job. And we've also just recently passed a law where you're not allowed to do drug testing until a job's been offered. And, you know, it really doesn't affect an employer's right to have a drug policy, because they're allowed to test after an offer's been made. But prior to making an offer, they're not allowed to do drug testing. And again, I think this is a very progressive progressive attitude, and it helps so many returning citizens. I hope it will help them re-enter the job market.
No, I think that's great. You know, I want to definitely make it a point to commend Councilmember Vincent Orange on that legislation.
Yeah.
There's another piece of legislation that took effect to earlier this week with not that much fanfare, but I think it has a significant impact, especially as it relates to marijuana. So Councilmember Grasso introduced and passed legislation that allows individuals to get their records sealed for marijuana. So if you have a criminal record as it relates to marijuana possession or, you know, some marijuana charge, now that marijuana has been officially legalized, you can go down to the Superior Court, fill out a form, and then the burden is on the courts to prove that your record shouldn't be sealed. So that significantly lowers the burden for individuals to, you know, have their criminal records appear inside of a background check and, you know, face a lot of the collateral consequences of coming out of prison and having a criminal record. All those sort of things are eliminated with this new piece of legislation that just took effect last week. So definitely want to highlight that and, you know, give credit to Councilmember Grasso, who did some really good work on passing that legislation.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, again, I wonder how much of this has to do, you know, the way we approach this, doctor, with race again. You know, it seems to me now, when we got rid of prohibition, we did it by constitutional amendment. So that was an all-sweeping kind of way to reform the law. And this has certainly been done piecemeal. But it also seems to me that we didn't deal with these issues in those days. We just said, okay, you couldn't drink before, and now you can drink. We didn't have to, you know, put in all these kind of incremental steps to get where we wanted to go. And do you think, why do you think we're doing this so incrementally around America, and we haven't been able, because I know you're involved in the national, a national coalition to make this happen. Why can't we make it happen nationally, do you think?
You know, it's very interesting that you bring this topic up, because so let's think about how prohibition came into place, right? So there was at least prohibition of alcohol, and then I'm going to compare it to prohibition of marijuana. So prohibition of alcohol was, you know, passed by amendment, and, you know, it occurred nationally, and then it was only in existence for about, you know, less than two decades, and then it was repealed. So there were not a lot of additional sorts of layering into the legislatures of states and national government for alcohol prohibition. But when you compare that to marijuana prohibition, which is now, you know, approaching the 50-year mark, unfortunately, you look at the way that it's built in, and it's built in deeply into all facets of national law. The way, like, so I was taking a look at this maybe last week. If you look at the Sentencing Commission guidelines, so the way that they sentence people for possession of drugs other than marijuana is using an equivalent weight of marijuana to define the sentencing. So, for example, if you have if you're convicted with possession of like a quarter ounce of heroin, there's an equivalent weight of marijuana that determines the sentence for that. So then you also look at the propagation of, you know, the Controlled Substances Act into state legislatures. It's like very deeply embedded into the system, this prohibition of marijuana. And we can't, at least at this point in time, we can't, you know, create a national consensus towards ending the prohibition. We have to kind of take it state by state by state and you know, work up instead of coming at it from a top-down approach.
Wow.
Well, and you know what seems strange to me, too? I mean, I've read a little about the history of it, and I know that marijuana was not prohibited for, and I can't remember when, the 30s or 40s or 50s, when they first started a ban. But it seems to me that with the introduction of the drug czar and some other things on the national level back in the 1980s, maybe, late 1980s, we started to freak out about it. You know, when I grew up in the 1960s, and when I used to go to a rock concert, everybody smoked pot. I mean, thousands of people sitting on a lawn. Nobody got upset about it. The police didn't rush in, start making arrests, anything like that. But it seemed that that seemed to end slowly. And then at the end of the 1980s, we started to get a lot tougher on enforcement. Do you know why that is?
Yeah. So, yeah, if you look at the way the history of this is all taking shape in, the Controlled Substances Act was passed in 1971, which put marijuana in Schedule One. And ironically, the Controlled Substances Act also created this commission called the National Commission on Marijuana and Drug Abuse, which created a report called the Schaefer Report, which recommended that marijuana be criminalized nationally due to the fact that, you know, the negative effects of marijuana use were not significant enough to justify the criminal penalties for this. This report came out in 1972. Unfortunately, the Nixon administration completely ignored this report, and marijuana remained Schedule One. But states took this report and started taking heed of some of the recommendations, and you know, states like Colorado, Oregon, North Carolina, California, started moving towards decriminalizing marijuana. This was in the mid-70s in the Carter administration. Then the Nixon administration came, and this is when the war on drugs kind of took this outsized role inside the way that we conduct our, like, policing policy in the United States. And if you look at the graphs from about 1980 to the present day, you'll see that the incarceration rate has gone up 700%. That the United States has spent $1.5 trillion over that time in trying to enforce drug policies through the war on drugs. And, you know, we've gotten really to the point where we are now the, you know, world's leader in prison populations. And, you know, that's a really unfortunate sort of byproduct of the war on drugs.
Yeah, that's terrible. And, you know, we know that, you know, we know that marijuana has been maligned for a very long time. Those of us that were in college in the 1970s remember the movie Reefer Madness, which came out, I don't know when it came out, in the 50s or 60s, and was just, you know, if you saw it today, you would think that it was really a spoof, a skit from Saturday Night Live. But unfortunately, it's the way the federal government felt about the drug.
Well, let me ask you another question, kind of taking a different angle. You know, a lot of people have asked me, coming, you know, from outside of D.C., well, you know, who are are the people, who funds this campaign, and who are the people that were, you know, out in the streets, you know, promoting it? Was it all your hippies? I mean, I didn't see that. But what would you say to people who would say, you know, well, how did you get your funding, and what kind of people were out there? Were they volunteers, or did you pay them, or, you know, what was your grassroots organization like?
Sure. So, you know, I work for an organization, Drug Policy Alliance, where we played a significant role in funding the campaign. We are made up, a nonprofit organization made up of about 370,000 people across the nation, generating funding from there. We get funding from a whole host of different donors, George Soros included. As it relates to the District of Columbia, the effort was a conjunction between Drug Policy Alliance, the DC Cannabis Campaign, David Garner's Magical Soaps, and a whole host of people within the district. So when we were gathering signatures, we got, you know, about, I'd say 500, 600 people from the district, and even people outside of the district who came in and wanted to, you know, get on and join the campaign and help gather 57,000 signatures to put Initiative 71 on the ballot. After we got on the ballot, we were able to engage with and coordinate with a whole host of different groups, the ACLU, groups like We Act Radio, Collective Power, a number of different faith-based organizations, a number of different religious leaders across the city, all under the auspices of, you know, looking at this from a racial justice standpoint. And so it was really a community-based effort, and that's why you saw that the numbers, the way they came in on election night, you know, we got 70.1% of the vote. That's the highest percentage for a marijuana legalization initiative ever. No initiative has even come close to that, and that it just speaks to the, you know, level of engagement and collaboration and work that we put together towards forming a broad-based coalition that kind of encompassed a lot of the different activist communities across the city.
Wow. Well, let me just say on that note that, yes, Kathleen and I were running a campaign in the fall, and we were very jealous. One, because you had so many good people out on the street, and we were competing for signatures. You know, and people would look at us and say, "Oh, this is, look, these guys are trying to get something done. This is just another dumb politician trying to get elected." So that was the problem. And two, I think we admired the coalition that you put together. How, you know, obviously there were a lot of young people involved, but there were, it was a very diverse group of people that we saw. Yes. While we were campaigning out on the street. And, you know, that's always been a problem in our movement, in the statehood movement, is bringing people in and getting them motivated. And we're always attempting to broaden our coalition. And we were very impressed by the amount of people that showed up. And I think all of us that were involved in the campaigns in the fall of 2014 knew that this was going to pass. Right. Long before the vote was taken, just by the enthusiasm that you guys were able to create and the amount of people that were brought into the process. And how many you ended up with, like, 60,000 signatures, didn't you?
Exactly. Yeah, it was 57,000 signatures. You know, we knew that we were going to pass. We were going to be victorious from, you know, like you said, a long time before. But it wasn't about just being victorious. We had to really, like, push to get the mark up there, because we knew that, you know, we would be victorious at the ballot box, but, you know, we would face significant hurdles after the election, you know, given the status of the district and its lack of self-determination. So by being intentional about, you know, raising the number up to something that is outsized, it got more votes than everything else on the ballot, minus Eleanor Holmes Norton.
Right.
You know, it makes it really hard to ignore this. Like, it's not a matter of, you know, oh, well, there was a majority of people. It was kind of more of like overwhelming consensus amongst people in the District of Columbia that we wanted to put this to an end. And, you know, when you can bring people in the district together to, you know, speak with one voice, it becomes that much harder to ignore.
Well, that's my question to you. I'm sorry, Mike, but, you know, in the 2 years that we've been hosting this show, the one thing that we've always asked a lot of the statehood people and people out there who listen to us, you know, what is it going to take for people in D.C. to understand that statehood is what they have to pursue, that that's the only way that they're really going to be able to pass their own laws and have self-determination? And we would say, what is it going to take? Because I was always shocked to see so few people at rallies or involved in the issue who live in D.C., especially maybe the 30s, young people starting out, married, starting their home, having young children. And yet, I mean, do you think this is something that the marijuana issue is making people in D.C. realize that they have to really push for statehood, they have to get involved, and they have to really, really work for it and get involved? Do you think that those people who were for the marijuana, passing of marijuana, understand now and maybe will join the statehood movement?
You know, I absolutely think that there's an opportunity to, you know, bring these two groups together. The reality of it is, you know, as we move forward in gaining rights for the District of Columbia, they're not going to come by negotiating with Congress. You have to, like, the Congress is just not going to acquiesce and give them district, you know, self-determination. It's going to have to come through a conflict and through, you know, struggle and a fight. And, you know, what people in the press cover, at least nowadays, is conflict. A lot of the press is generated and moved by conflicts between two entities, whether it be Republicans or Democrats, the president and Congress. If we're serious about highlighting this and bringing people's awareness to it, you know, the district has to the elected officials of the district have to be willing to step up and fight, like, more than just, you know, talking and having rhetoric, like actively using provisions and parts of the government as even offensive weapons, as much as that may sound controversial, like using the contingency reserve funds as a matter of, you know, principle to say that while you might block us here on this fiscal year, we're going to take money because we believe that the district should set its own rights. We're going to take money that we have been able to save from previous years to enact rules that we think and that the people of the District of Columbia want. That's how you get, you know, people to see that there's a confrontation between Congress and the district, and that's how you generate the media coverage, and that's how you get people to, you know, see that there's a difference, and you have to draw a line of the same. You know, you either stand on the side of, you know, democracy and self-representation, or you stand on the side of tyranny and, you know, overreach and big government. And, you know, when you make the lines that stark and clear and you create that conflict, then more and more people are willing to get in on it and fight right on the right side of history.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, that's the most important thing you've said all night, Dr. Burnett, from my perspective, you know, is that we don't get involved enough in that sort of thing, and we don't stand up enough, and we don't use what's available to us to make it happen. We put hardly any money into this, our effort for statehood. And so, yeah, that would be great if we could get more people to do that and more elected officials to do that. You know, we stepped in the street. Many of us got arrested. Some of us, like myself, went to trial over issues that similar issues that have come up with the budget. But, you know, we don't go up enough, up to Capitol Hill and make a stink. You and Adam and I were on the front page of the Washington Post not long ago because we stepped into the leader's office in the Senate, and we demanded that they meet with us on when they were considering this heinous budget proposal. But there should have been more elected officials with us. It shouldn't have been just you and me and Adam. It should have been the head of the city council and the mayor as well. So no, I agree with you 100%, and we'd like to get, you know, what we can. We'd like to inject this kind of enthusiasm into people in the Wilson Building and get them up there and get them to stand up. And again, we're proud of the mayor for doing exactly that a couple of weeks ago, and we hope she'll continue to do that.
No, I, I'm sorry. Go ahead. No, okay. I was going to say, you know, we have the real opportunity right now. You know, people that are listening to your show should reach out and talk to the mayor and say, you know, use the contingency reserve fund to continue the fight to get sensible public safety policies around marijuana in District Columbia. Once you highlight this fight, it will deter Republicans, or they'll at least, and I say Republicans because it is always Republicans that are,
yes, it is. Know,
get a appropriations rider onto the District of Columbia for whatever social policy issue that they may have. It will cause them to take a second thought on or take a second thought as to whether or not they want to move forward with this, because they may try to, you know, prevent the district from moving forward in its use of funding. But if the district continues to enact policies in spite of these riders, then the Republicans will try to do one of two things. They will either stop doing these appropriations riders, or they will try to, like, take away the self-governance of the district, either by taking away these funds or, you know, stripping the district of its locally elected officials. And when that would be a gross overreach. And, you know, ultimately, that would be what would cause people to rally to the cause of locally elected governance. Like, the district isn't doing anything crazy. They're just trying to, the elected officials of the district aren't doing anything crazy. They're just trying to pass sensible policies, and Republicans and Congress keep getting in the way. So, you know, I think that we have to be intentional about thinking about what exactly it is that we value. And I know that everybody in the district values self-government, and we have to fight for that at every possible opportunity.
And really, our politicians are doing what we've told them to do, which is that it overwhelmingly passed. People want this, and that's what politicians are there to do. They are to make sure that the wishes of the voters are, you know, enacted or implemented. So it's just amazing. I think it comes down to basics governing. This is what the people want. Therefore, politicians have got to go out there, and sometimes it might be putting themselves on the line or getting arrested. But if they do it together, you know, it's just so much more powerful. If they would join and say, okay, you know, come and get us and send us to jail. If they had actually done that, I think it will blow up in their face, Congress's face, because nobody wants to see Congress. I mean, this is the fear of people in Arizona, government coming in and, you know, knocking down the door of your city council or your homes to tell you, no, you're not going to do it. You're going to do it our way. So, you know, and those are Republicans that have that fear. So it's just kind of very interesting how these arguments come about, because if you're a true Republican, you've got to be for states' rights and self-determination. I mean, that's what their whole stand is about.
Well, and as we run out of time here, we're almost out of time. So I'd like to ask you, given what we just said, what's next, Doctor? I know that Adam Eidegger is busy sewing hats. But there's something coming up on Capitol Hill. But what's planned next for you guys?
Well, you know, we are going to continue to you know, move this issue forward. We have the DC Cannabis Campaign is putting together a seed share at the end of this month, where individuals can come and get seeds, marijuana seeds, and, you know, take those seeds, go back to their homes, and, you know, start the process of growing marijuana.
But that has to be, I'm sorry, right? Doctor, that's inside your house, so you can't do it on a balcony, right? You can't
exactly.
Do it out in the backyard?
Closed and locked facility is the rules of the law, of the land, and you have to, you know, do it inside your house and, you know, treat it like a potted plant inside your house. No pun intended, but that's how you have to do it. But so that's coming up here in the short term. You know, we're going to continue to raise the issue of the contingency reserve funding opportunity that the district has to, you know, be able to step out on this policy. You know, there's an open and active budget gap that people are talking about in the district this budget season right now, the district. And, you know, if you're really looking at an opportunity to bring in additional revenue, the conservative estimates of the CFO are that, you know, taxing and regulating marijuana will bring in $130 million annually in the District of Columbia. So there's a great opportunity to close the budget gap there. So, you know, we're going to continue to highlight all these opportunities and push elected officials to take this fight to the next level.
Well, thank you for being with us tonight, Dr. Burnett. I want to tell all our listeners that you can follow these guys at dcmj.org or on Facebook and Twitter, DCMJ2014. And we're so glad that you came on the show and shed some light on this. I think this has been a great discussion, and I'm so happy for all the work that you've done. Thank you so much. It's hard for me to laud praise on you, Doctor, because I'm a Maryland alumni. March Madness just started. You went to Duke. But I'm trying to get, you know, they tell me that I have to get over my animus because we've moved to the Big Ten. But
You guys are not our rivals. Don't get it twisted. You guys are not our rivals. We are going to, you know, go far in the March Madness tournament, and, you know, we're going to bring another championship back home to Durham.
Oh, all right. Wow. Well, we'll see if that happens. And especially if it doesn't, we'll have you back on the show. But thank you so much for being here. And thanks for shining a light on this for us. And after I give Kathleen the last word, we're going to play a song in honor of our guest and the 115,000 D.C. voters who voted for Prop 71. Go ahead, Kathleen.
Just thank you so much, Dr. Burnett. It's been really enlightening, and I think it also is really interesting because as we talk through this all, we can see the things that we have to watch, and I think it's exciting for statehood. I think it's a whole group of people that you know, maybe will be coming into the fold to realize that statehood is what we need for D.C. And with that, to the audience, thanks so much for listening. Upcoming shows, we're going to be talking about ERA, guns, D.C. statehood, of course, is always part of it, border security, college loans, the presidential race, unemployment, especially for us old geysers like, you know, me and Michael, and just a whole host of things. So thank you so much for listening. Thank you, Dr. Burnett. And with that, let's listen to the song by the Young Rascals.